And now from the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
While much of the rest of the nation was watching the eclipse, I was sitting down with former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi for a rollicking chat for a democracy series I'm hosting this spring at Arizona State University. We touched on the election and some of the key issues churning our politics in the world today. One of those, of course, is Gaza, and our conversation was punctuated at times by pro-Palestinian protesters. But I must confess, it was not your typical Axe Files. I wanted to focus on leadership power and the lessons she's learned about their use during her long historic career. But you put Pelosi in a room full of young people and, well, at times I just had to sit back and listen to her share her rich and colorful stories. I hope you will too. Here's that conversation.
Thank you, Dean. Speaker Emerita, that's a mouthful. Speaker Pelosi, welcome. Emerita, what is that? It has meaning, right?
It means happiness.
Yeah. I raise that because you look, every time I see you on TV, I see, boy, she looks a lot more relaxed than she did when she was running the joint. Is that true?
Well, you be the judge, and I say this to Hakeem Jeffries, who's going to be speaker before you know it, that for 20 years, I was leader or speaker. I meant every day I was responsible for every word that was said on the floor of the House from the Democratic side and as Speaker across the board. So you never slept. I mean, you up until all hours, especially if you represent California or Arizona, you're
right.
There's more time to work. And then that. And then on top of that, so that's your policy work, your official work, and then on top of that, to make sure that you win the elections. So you don't even have a moment. It's a beautiful privilege. It was really lovely. And I'm so thrilled that we are in such good hands now. And I don't know how political we can be here, but just civics. In November, Hakeem Jeffries will become the Speaker of the House. Yeah.
So, I was driving down here, listening to the eclipse on the radio, and lamenting the fact that we in Arizona, sitting in Arizona, were sort of bypassed by the bulk of it because it's a rare and historic event. But
Texas.
But we have the privilege of having you, and you're sort of a rare and historic person. As well, so, and it was when you became Speaker in 2007, you became a historic figure immediately because you were the first woman, and thus far the only woman to be Speaker of the House. Now, when people talk about you, they say she was a historic figure because she may have been the most effective Speaker in the history of the country, and so I want to spend a little time on leadership.
Okay.
And some lessons you learned about leadership and power. And we had this discussion once on this podcast way back when.
Yes.
And I asked you about growing up in your household in Baltimore, because people associate you with the city of San Francisco.
Yes, sir.
But you're the daughter of a former mayor of Baltimore, former congressman. Your brother was the mayor of Baltimore. What was it like growing up in that house, and what lessons did you learn that you carried with you when you became Speaker of the House?
Well, thank you, David, for the invitation to be here. May I first say how honored I am to be at ASU. What a fabulous institution, Dean. Thank you for your lovely welcome to all of us. I also love being in Arizona because my daughter has lived here, 25 years?
Yep.
We spend a time here, a visiting family. And it's a very special place. And now, in terms of leadership, yeah, I let me just put it in a little bit of a perspective. I was born and raised in Baltimore, Maryland, into a very Italian Catholic family. We were devoutly Catholic, proud of our Italian American heritage, fiercely patriotic, loving America, and in our case, staunchly democratic. We saw our connection between our faith, the Gospel of Matthew, when I was hungry, you fed me, when I was homeless, you sheltered me, you know, I'm sure you must have some familiarity with that. As our civic mission.
Nancy Pelosi, you are complicit in genocide.
Yeah, I appreciate your saying.
We're going to be talking about this.
You can say what you will about me. But I resent your saying genocide, Joe.
Joe Biden has been the strongest advocate
for humanitarian assistance for the Palestinians. He has been advocating for humanitarian assistance for the Palestinians for months now. That has been held up by the other side of the aisle. But they don't want to talk about that.
Let us continue. Okay. We'll get to this issue.
See,
I
don't mind talking over them if you won't mind listening.
Okay.
So what was interesting, what I think you might find interesting, is people said to me, how did your upbringing in Baltimore prepare you for being in San Francisco, which I've been there for over 50 years. My husband was born and raised there. And so, actually it was just that about respect, but the dignity and worth of every person. And if you want me to, I'm going to the religious aspects of that.
What I want to ask you about, honestly, because I'm just an old hack, I want to ask you about politics. Because I want to ask you, when I asked you years ago, I said, what did you learn watching your father through elections and campaigns? Right. So you said, I learned how to count.
Yeah, that's important.
Yes, but tell me about that. Tell me how, because I have a feeling that you learned some skills that ended up being very useful when you were trying to marshal your forces in the Congress.
Well, I did know that you have to win, and in order to win, you have to have the most votes, and if you don't win, that means you didn't have the most votes. So I would watch them as a little girl when they would take out these yellow legal pads and say, in order to win citywide, we have to have X number of votes. That means in your district, you have to come up with this many, that many, that many, that many, that many, that many. And so everybody had their assignment as to how many votes they would have to bring out. My brother, Tommy, who became mayor of Baltimore, he was my oldest. We were seven. I was raised with five boys because one died of pneumonia. But my brother Tommy, who was the oldest, he became mayor too. But when he was a young, like a teenager, my father ran for mayor of Baltimore. Well, this was a big deal. Italian American in Little Italy of Baltimore. Baltimore never had a Catholic mayor. Leapfrog over the Irish. I say that with my grandsons, Liam, Sean, and Ryan. Leapfrog over the Irish and win that. So then, in any event, what happened was he took my brother up to the roof of the house, and he said, Tommy said to my father, do you think we can win, Daddy? And he said, well, let's go on the roof of the house. They go to the roof of the house. They see all these cars converging on the headquarters. It's like 5 o'clock in the morning, bright lights converging on the headline to pick up their material to get out the vote. And he said, well, I don't know if we're going to win, but we know we're going to give them a run for it because everybody had their assignment on it. And so it was nothing that you took for granted or anything that you assumed. Assume, that word meant ass of you and me. You do not assume anything. You just know that you will have the vote. So watching politics and poker, you know, that's what it was in those days, I understood that's what you had to do. And that meant in elections as well as in
It also meant sort of understanding who those voters were and having relationships with those voters. I know you kept the files assiduously on all the constituents.
Well, they say that, but the point is that when we lived in the neighborhood, so people would come if they needed a bed in the city hospital or a place to stay in the projects or getting somebody out of jail or into jail, whatever it happened to be, how do you direct them? People really didn't really know how to use the functions of government, and so I knew how to do. I could get somebody on welfare or anything else like that when I was a little girl because I could hear what my mother said about that when people would come to the door. But it wasn't doing them any favor. It was just giving them guidance as to this is what you have to do that. And when that would happen, when you say the file, it would only be, well, David got a place in the projects, or David got a job with the city, or David got
went to jail.
Whatever it is, but not the jail part. And so when somebody else needed a job or this or that, you would just say, David might be able to give you some advice. Mm-hmm. So it was like a paying forward on it. It wasn't about politics. It was really about just paying forward.
But people had relationships with these voters. When you were Speaker of the House, you were sort of famous for knowing who your members were and knowing what they needed, what motivated them, who influenced them. And we were joking before, my wife Susan, who's here today, we were in Rome and just had dinner with Joe Donnelly, who's the ambassador to the Holy See now, to the Vatican. But he was a congressman when we were working together on the Affordable Care Act, and we were 20 votes short, and you were, president said, let Nancy do her thing. And you did your thing, but Donnelly reported that one of the things that you did that is you had the legendary former late now president of Notre Dame, Father Hesburgh, call Donnelly, who was very devout and represented South Bend, to lobby him on your behalf. I mean, you must have carried around a fantastic amount of information in your head about these people.
Well, Father Hesburgh was just a remarkable figure. And I had to fight, don't tell anybody I told you this, the bishops. Thank God I had the nuns. Thank God for the nuns, because that's how we were able to build the outside support. So with these things, whether it's an inside maneuvering, you're inside maneuvering to make sure you're going to have the vote. You're going to have the votes. This is a question of when, and you don't take it up until you do. And so it was no question in my mind. We had this magnificent president who was committed to establishing affordable health care in America. And people had tried for 100 years, from Teddy Roosevelt. They tried and tried. Franklin Roosevelt, he tried, but could get Social Security, but not health care. And then LBJ and Harry Truman before him and all the rest. And now the president was committed to this. And we were not going to miss any opportunity because we considered it a pillar, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, Affordable Care Act, and we were going to make it happen. So it was going to happen. Now, when you're maneuvering internally, you get your vote. You know, you see, make sure everybody understands. We read the bill all together like this in the room. People could ask questions, improve this or that. But without the outside mobilization, it makes it very difficult. So you have your inside maneuvering and your outside mobilization. So we were moving, I mean, since we're talking about affordable care, it is a story. I just wrote a book and it's in there, but I'll give you the abbreviated version. I know it's already too late for that, but nonetheless, the abbreviated version. We have the votes in the House. We know we're going to do this just well, so well, and the press. Then Senator Kennedy, rest his soul, died, and a Republican won the seat in Massachusetts. And the press said to me, it's done, you're done, yeah,
it was
over.
Like they were hanging crepe on the
people. Yeah, there was, I said, I said, you know what, we are not, our House Democrats are not going to miss this generational opportunity for health care. We're just not going to do it. So they said, well, how are you going to do it? I said, well, we're not letting anything stand in our way. If there's a fence, we'll push open the gate. If that doesn't work, we'll climb the fence. If that doesn't work, we'll pole vault in. If that doesn't work, we'll parachute in. But we are not allowing anything to stand in the way for health care for American people. So, after it happened, they said, which one did you do? So actually, and that was a couple months later, we just pushed open the gate because we had not only the number of votes to do so, we had the outside mobilization. We had the nuns, we had the little lobbyists, the children who born with so many challenges and so at such high cost. We had people with disabilities, we had everybody who cared, all those pushing open that door. So when we talk about any of these things, it's important to talk about our strength internally in the Congress. But what's really important is the outside mobilization. Abraham Lincoln said, public sentiment is everything. With it, you can accomplish almost anything. Without it, practically nothing. But for public sentiment to prevail, people have to know. People have to know. When I called Father Hesburgh, I already had the votes then, but I wanted more, you know? I wanted more. So I called him, I said, Father, the bishops are not all there with us because they're not reading the bill. It does nothing to change the Hyde Amendment. It does nothing to change
funding
that.
Funding for abortion. Yeah.
It doesn't do any of that. So in any event, so when I called him, I said, the bishops, but the nuns are with us. So he calls Joe Donnelly, who's a beautiful, lovely man, pro-life, but many of the pro-life members of Congress were with us on this bill. And he says, Joe, the Speaker and I need your vote on the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, well, it was influential.
I love the way he said it, though.
I could talk about the Affordable Care Act forever. I should mention to you, I spoke to a class the other day. I see the professor here. And one of the young people who was there told me that but he had three heart surgeries that he would not have been able to have, but for the Affordable Care Act.
He wouldn't afford it, no.
Susan knows this, so we have a child with a pre-existing medical condition, and it was terribly difficult, epilepsy, when she was a child, and we almost went bankrupt. I wept the night the Affordable Care Act passed because I knew that others wouldn't have to go through what our family did back then. So I'm very grateful to you. I know the role you played. In some ways, you're downplaying your role, although I did enjoy watching you parachute in that but, you know, one thing that you did
let me just say why I came here today. I have great respect. Oh, I love the institution. Any invitation I would love to have, but David's invitation, very special to me because he brought us this great president of the United States, Barack Obama, a gift to America, and he was so instrumental in that. But also because he and Susan are such magnificent parents, and they just glow with their love of their children.
Right? Thank you.
And that, to me, it's all about
Susan glows,
about the
and
children.
I bask in her glow. So
I'll accept that.
I mean, everything you said was worth hearing, but where I was going was even on the issue of abortion, you negotiated language to make clear what should have been clear, and to make it possible for pro-life Democrats who wanted to come on board. And that word compromise is an important word. And it's become tarnished in our contemporary politics. And when you forge legislation, what is your expectation about having to change, to adapt to when you talk to a member on either side their vote? Do you always get what you want?
Let me just say on that score, though, that on the Affordable Care Act, we had the person who wrote the Hyde Amendment, not Hyde, he's no longer with us, but Jim Oberstar wrote the Hyde Amendment. Very pro-life members were supporting the bill because they knew that the bill did not violate the Hyde Amendment. So it was kind of an angle, but it wasn't really a fact as to what it did. But to give more clarity to it, we want to remove all doubt that anybody might have, and the president.
But that's part of the process.
The president was very instrumental in that. You know.
I will say.
I'd have to say one more thing. One more thing. That night, the president called. You will like to hear this. You tell me. That night, the president called and he said, "Tonight, because you passed the Affordable Care Act, I'm happier than I was the night
yes.
I was elected
yes,
president of the United States."
He told all of us that. By the way,
what I said was, "Well, I was happy tonight, jubilant, tearfully, but I wasn't happier than I was the night you were elected president, because if you were not elected president of the United States, we would not have this victory tonight."
Well, I don't want to get between the two of you. So, but I will say, Steve Israel, one of your great former colleagues, said about you, when you walk into Nancy's office, two things catch your eye. There are chocolates on the table and a baseball bat in the corner. And he said she's perfectly comfortable using either to persuade you. So on this issue of abortion, I know you don't like to, the mention of Donald Trump, but he is the Republican, putative Republican or de facto Republican nominee, and he released a video today on this issue of abortion. You probably saw that. He said that...
He's leaving it up to the states.
The states. Yeah. That's what he said. What was your reaction to that? He did take credit for the
destroying
court and scuttling Roe versus
yeah.
Wade.
Yeah. Well, he takes great pride in the fact that this Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Now, as I say, I come from a very, as my daughter Nancy can tell you, very pro-life Italian-American Catholic family in Baltimore, Maryland. They don't support or oppose anybody because of a woman's right to choose, but that's what they are. They think I'm a little exuberant about the subject, but that's their problem, not mine. So here's the thing. In the history of our country, from the very beginning, these beautiful visionaries put together a country founded on a principle of equality and the rest, unlike anything that ever happened in the history of the world. They wrote a constitution. They wrote a Declaration of Independence. They wrote a constitution. Thank God they made it amendable, because for their compromises, they had slavery. They had other things in the constitution. Women did. And so they made it amendable. And from that time on, when they ratified the Constitution, freedom has always expanded. Abolish slavery, black men have the right to vote, eventually women have the right to vote, all these things, a woman having the right to choose her reproductive health. Then marriage equality passed by the Supreme Court. Until these guys came along and others came along and reversed the expansion of freedom that was central to America by saying that women would not have the right to choose. That was a reversal. And he takes great pride in that, what's his name does. And now he's afraid of the politics of it. So while he brags about reversing Roe v. Wade, he is now saying it's up to the states. So it's getting mixed reviews on his side of the world in terms of, that is supposed to be gone. You know, no abortion. I don't even like to use the word, but, and so it'll be interesting to see how he deals with it. From our standpoint, he's talking about banning a woman's right to choose.
What would the effect be if you can't pass a national law encoding protections for women?
It will be, we're seeing some of it now. We're seeing people coming close to death. You can't say that, you know what, I always say to the Republicans, why don't you get a lesson in the birds and the bees? Do you know how all this stuff works? Do you know how this happens? This is not a subject of conversation only. It's a reality of life about how you have a baby, how you might miscarry, and if you do, you need to have treatment for that, but they don't allow that. I mean, this is very, very, very dangerous. It's very dangerous. It's cruel. And it just cannot stand. And I don't...
How big an issue you think this will be in this campaign? It was in 2022.
Yeah, it'll be an issue. But it is not just about this issue. I mean, in other words, you have to enlarge the whole thing. It's about respecting people and their opinions and their freedom. The issue of a woman's right to choose is a freedom issue. It's a democracy issue. It's a democracy. So you have to take it to that place. You have to take it to that place. It's about freedom of choice. And it's a kitchen table issue. I always talk about, you know, where you got the big room with the big table, the boardroom, the corporate room, the room in the speaker's office, the room in the cabinet office, the room, the kitchen table. That's the powerful room in our country where people make decisions about their lives, about their budgets and what's going to be important to them, how they save or not for their children's education, how they size and timing, if that you have a family, all of that. Their health care costs enter into that. Many public policy issues are affected by their decisions and our decisions at that kitchen table.
Yeah, can I ask you about that?
And a woman's right to choose is a kitchen table
issue. I thought I'd try.
Yeah, so it's an economic issue, it's a freedom issue, it's a respect for women issue.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support. Your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, back to the show.
Can I talk to you about the kitchen table? Because I quite agree with you. That's the discussion around the kitchen table is so important in campaigns and elections. And there's no doubt that we have made significant progress during the horrible days of 2021 at the height of the pandemic. The economy was on its back, high unemployment and so on. And the president talks a lot about the progress that we've made. But people around the kitchen tables say, things are more expensive because they are all over the world. Inflation has raised prices. They're paying 20% more for groceries, for gas, for rent. Wouldn't it make more sense to say we are fighting for lower prices? That this is the economic issue of this moment, and this is what, rather than extolling how good the economy is.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, in other words, people. I say this all the time to our candidates. People don't want to hear you tell them that you deserve to be reelected because you did this, 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 and this. Nobody deserves anything. But it does qualify you when you say, I am going to get the job done. So I think it's not that elections are always about the future, not about what you did, although that's a good calling card, but it's not about... It's about the future. So what I think, frankly, in the Obama years, too, there was a tendency to say, we've gotten this done.
Yeah, and we learned our lesson. And,
yeah, but you have to be talking about the future. Now, there are lots of reasons why there's the cost of living goes up. One of them is, of course, what happened with COVID and the supply chain and all the rest of that contributes to that. You know what else contributes to it? War. War is something, what's happening in Ukraine, whether it's energy from Russia, fertilizer from Russia, grain from Ukraine, and the rest, has contributed to the cost of living. And somehow people got the idea that inflation and cost of were interchangeable. Our inflation is lower than any of the developed countries.
But it's
in the
cumulative,
world.
Right? So they're feeling the cumulative effect. People are feeling the cumulative effect of years of inflation. That's why prices are 20% higher. But I take your point about the war. We should talk about that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was sort of meandering to a question about Ukraine, and because this seems like we're in an eventful week here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had a three-vote majority when you were two votes. All right, who's counting? You count. That's what, you had a two-vote majority, and yet you were able to pass a lot of the legislation of the president's legislation, the infrastructure bill, the advanced manufacturing bill.
The rescue package.
Yeah. Climate bill.
Climate.
Yeah. Health care.
Chips.
Yes. No, no.
Welcome to Arizona.
Yes.
The
with
chips
a two-vote
bill.
Majority. You did it with a two-vote majority. First of all, does Speaker Johnson ever sidle up the aisle and whisper to you, what's your secret?
Can
you,
no.
But tell, what was the difference between your two-vote majority and his now one-vote majority that makes it so hard to get anything done?
We're hopeful that we will get something done this week. He said
on
he's
Ukraine,
going to.
Do you feel that it,
well,
you
we,
will?
We have to. I mean, we cannot allow Ukraine. We must win in Ukraine. Democracy is on the line in Ukraine. He knows that. Now, of course, there is a Putin caucus on the Republican side of the aisle. History, not politics, Gene. There's a Putin caucus. They like Putin. That's good, actually. And it's scary. In fact, the chairman, a Republican chairman of the intelligence committee in the House, said yesterday, it was in the news yesterday, that the Russian propaganda has taken over the Republican side of the aisle. So in any event, we have to win for what it means to Ukraine, but what it means to the countries surrounding Ukraine, some of them NATO, some of them not, all of them targets of Putin, and they know it. And also democracy. Democracy is on the line there. So I think the speaker appreciates that and knows that. We just have to come up with something.
So can I ask you a question about this, though? Because he has sort of the sword hanging over his head. Yeah. But one of the things that you did when you got re-elected as speaker in 2019 was you changed this rule about governing this motion to vacate the chair to make it harder to implement. When Kevin McCarthy became speaker, he gave all that back and made it possible for one person start the process of removing the Speaker of the House. And as you know, you're...
Well, it was the incredible shrinking speakership, you know. They take it down to one person can out you. But here's the thing.
My question is, are you going to help him? Would you help the Speaker if he puts this on the floor? Because the threat is that would be invoked.
Well, I don't... The question would be, will all the Republicans stick with that, you know? But anyway, let me just say on this thing. This is about the integrity of the House of Representatives. And I told John Boehner when he was Speaker, and I said to extend it to Paul Ryan, you can't let... Back to our old subject, but when John Boehner was Speaker, he lost. We beat him in a vote to save Planned Parenthood. And the Republicans were furious with him. And they said they were going to oust him. And I said, you know, we're not letting you get ousted because we won on Planned Parenthood. It has nothing to do with you. It has everything to do with the integrity of the House. But he said, okay. But then he said, they're going to do this to me every week. I'm out of here.
Yeah, and he left.
He walked right out the door.
Yeah.
He walked right out the door the day after the Pope came. He's stayed for that, and then he walked right out the door. I don't blame him. But he just left, and then, so.
As did Speaker Ryan?
Yeah, well, it's the problem
want this
on
job?
Their side of the aisle. I can't psychoanalyze what that is, but I will say that it would be interesting to see how many Republicans really go along with that. because we have a nice rapport, but the Republicans wanted Donald Trump for speaker, and they got him.
Because he influences enough people
completely
that he can.
In touch. Mm-hmm. Although I think he knows, because the defense community, everybody is saying, you've got to send this money to Ukraine. And the bill has billions of dollars for humanitarian assistance for the Palestinians. The Republicans have an alternative bill that doesn't have the money for the Palestinians. So when they start talking about Genocide Joe and the rest of that, they've got another agenda. Of course, we're all concerned about what's happening to Palestinians. Many of us have been for a two-state solution for years, for decades, and disagree with Netanyahu. I mean, I think he's terrible. But Joe Biden has this money for the Palestinians, has always been for the two-state solution to give the Palestinians the dignity of their own state, which, of course, Netanyahu opposes.
Yeah. I mean, two things can be true at once. I mean, I'm the son of a Jewish refugee, so I feel strongly about this. And October 7th was unthinkable and
terrible.
But you can still weep for Palestinian children who are starving. You can still weep for Palestinian families who are, and these young people who stand here and disrupt are very passionate about it. And there are a lot of people who are passionate about it. President's in a tough spot, is he not? Because you want to allow Israel to secure itself, and he's providing the weaponry. We're providing the weaponry to do that. Mm-hmm. And yet we see what some of the results, the ancillary impacts of it, and they're pretty severe. You signed a letter on Friday, and I know it was specific to the World Central Kitchen attack, to hold up a transfer of additional weapons until there was a full investigation.
Which they did. Which they're doing, the investigation.
So you're
I thought the letter was gentle. I mean, there are those who would have had a letter that said, no aid to Israel because of that. No, it said, unless there is an investigation of how this happened. And Israel said right away that they would have it. And when they did, I said, okay, well, because we kind of tempered the letter, I went
well, we now have, we're coming up on another issue, which is that Netanyahu said today that they have a date chosen for the operation in Rafah, where most of the, where many Palestinians are now congregated.
It's terrible.
What are there red lines for you?
Well, look, our president of the United States has been a strong supporter of Israel. Going beyond strong support, we love Israel for what it has been.
I think your father was a strong supporter even before Israel was, he was a...
Yeah, well, my father was a member of Congress when he was a young boy. When he was a young boy in the neighborhood, see, we go back to Little Italy, but right next to there is the Jewish community, and he was a Shabbat goy. I don't know if you know what that is, but he used to go and light the furnace or the stove or whatever it is because Jewish people couldn't work on the Sabbath. So he was a Sabbath goy, non-Jewish person. And he learned Yiddish. So when he was 21 and could vote, he ran for office for state House of Delegates, then city council, and then eventually he was running for Congress. And when he was out there on the campaign, he was a great orator. Couldn't read a speech for $1 million, but he was a great orator. And he would turn the most hostile argument audience into the laughing and cheering. And all. I mean, he was just one of those kind of people. And he spoke Yiddish. So they would have him out. This group, they had pageants and parades and rallies about two things. One, United States has to do more to protect Jewish people in Europe. And two, establish. The White House has to be more aggressive and assertive in establishing a Jewish state in what was called Palestine at the time. He worshipped at the shrine of Franklin Roosevelt. You can just imagine coming from the neighborhood and all. But on those two scores, he challenged them to the point that he went to the floor of the House, stood up and said, you know, I'm speaking for the Hebrew Men's Army, and I want the record to show that 2 million Jewish people have been murdered in Europe for what they believe. This information is in the archives of the State Department and is well known to the administration. Mm-hmm. That was a real,
that took courage.
I know.
So I say
to Netanyahu, you don't mean anything to me. My love for Israel spring is in my DNA. So your approval of what I say or not doesn't, you know, what does that mean to me? Because I love Israel.
Chuck Schumer, you know, said that he called for new elections. He said Netanyahu was a barrier to ending the war and finding a solution, a two-state solution.
Well, Chuck Schumer was very courageous in his statement because Chuck and I even split on Iran. I mean, that was to stop the development of a nuclear weapon, but Chuck went with Israel on that. So he's been there with Israel every step of the way. He's a beautiful, devout Jewish person. He loves Israel. And for him to make that statement, I think took great courage. I'm so proud of him.
Can this be resolved with Netanyahu as prime minister? Are you worried about that?
I don't think, I mean, I've said this to Netanyahu over the years. I don't know whether you don't know how to make peace, you don't want to make peace, or you're afraid of peace. But you could be doing so much more instead of just throwing red meat to the crowd, you know, which is what he did. So I don't know that looking at his family background, you don't know his family background, the rest.
Yes.
But I think that he's interested in one thing, his own survival, and that's it.
Yeah, it's a bit of the situation that Trump is in.
Imagine that they're doing settlements now. When I first came to Congress, I was invited to go to a Jewish group to speak, and I look forward to this or that. But the main attraction that day was Jim Baker. George Herbert Walker Bush was president. George and
Baker
the big
was Secretary
room,
of State.
Baker said in the room, the United States will not extend loan guarantees as long as you continue supporting settlements. Oh my God, they just went crazy. And the place went crazy because. And now there's like almost two generations or a generation and a half of young people who have raised on these settlements.
Yeah,
very conservative. What is the purpose in saying in the cabinet of Netanyahu, we're going to go into Gaza and we're going to settle it ourselves. We're going to push all these people out. That is not a two-state solution. And I say to them, Israel is a Jewish democratic state. If you don't have a two-state solution, you're going to have many Palestinians and Arabs living in Israel and as a democratic state,
mm-hmm.
there could be change. And you know what some of them say to me? We don't have to allow them to vote. Then you're not a democratic state. So this is a big... We want Israel to be able to defend itself. What happened on October 7th was barbaric. And you don't see any of these people. These people live outside my house in the middle of the night. Needless to say, I don't need people ringing my doorbell in the middle of the night after what we've been through in the middle of the night in our home. But they don't say anything about the hostages. They don't say anything about Hamas, a terrorist organization. And that doesn't justify 32,000 people dying in Gaza. So there has to be, I think the President Biden has it within him because of his love of Israel, his knowledge of this and the rest, and his empathy for the people of Gaza, and understanding that for Israel, the solution is a two-state solution. So when Netanyahu would say, well, I don't like the two-state solution, I said, understand, the phrase has the word solution. If it isn't a solution, it's not a solution. We're talking about taking it to a place, as you said, can this be worked out, where there is a real solution.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
And now, back to the show.
I want to ask two things, and I'm almost embarrassed to suggest this, but I need short answers on this. Because
you want to hear about my father speaking Yiddish?
And don't give me the answers.
But that was interesting, wasn't it?
It was, yes. That was a great story. I didn't know that. But we're in Arizona. It's a border state, as California is a border state.
Yeah.
The issue of the border continues to be an extraordinary problem. And I think a political problem as well for the president. Mm-hmm. What do you suggest? There was a bill that the Senate passed, and it was killed after Trump said that he would not support it. Would you have voted for that bill, by the way?
Yeah, I didn't love it to death, but I would have voted for it.
It was tough. It was a tough bill on the border.
It was a compromise, and it was an answer. And that's the path we should have gone down. And it was most unfortunate, but that, again, Trump even exerted his power in the Senate. The Senate, he's not going to like this. But I tell them, and I told the speaker, when he came down from the podium, having been elected speaker, first thing I said to him is, I heard that you quoted Ronald Reagan. That was lovely. But I want you to read another Ronald Reagan speech.
Yeah.
It's the last speech he made as President of the United States. Ronald Reagan, now you Google it because I'm not going to do the whole thing because.
Yeah, yes.
This is the last speech I will make as President of the United States, and I want to communicate a message to a country that I love. Goes on to say that America is preeminent in the world because our door has been open. He talks about the Statue of Liberty being the beacon of hope, drawing people to America, and because of that, we are preeminent in the world. And if we ever decide to shut the door, we will no longer be preeminent in the world. Now, we have challenges, the problems that are happening in other countries, people coming. We have to address that.
Do you expect anything to come up on this, or is it now done because Trump said he doesn't want anything done before the election?
Well, he doesn't want it done before the election, not that he wants to solve the problem, because he wants to use it as an electoral thing. But there's a path. You know, there's a path. See, in any event, this is a hard crowd to deal with, and it hadn't always been this way. You know, I've worked with Republicans.
Yeah, well, I want to ask you about that. That's a great segue. Thank you. I'll grab them when I can. When you entered Congress in 1987, it was a different place.
Yeah.
There were battles between Republicans and Democrats, but there wasn't this sense of enmity that exists today.
Yeah.
What changed? How did this change? What are the things that are driving that sort of sense of, you're not just my opponent on an issue, but you are my enemy, or at least you have to appear to be my enemy, or my base will not tolerate it?
Yeah. You really want to know?
I wouldn't ask if I didn't.
It might take long.
Oh, no. Then
no,
forget about
it. Say, at that time.
Just give me the short version.
Just so you know what it is, at that time when we were there, we had differences of opinion. But in my leadership role, I have great respect for everybody there. And I always say that our tapestry that we want to weave as Democrats depends on everybody being in the color and the mix and the rest. So that's from our standpoint. How we deal with the other side is more like a kaleidoscope, like one bill, this side of the room, Republicans may be against, well, no, I'm sorry, but one side of the room might be against the other side of the room. Then on the next bill, back half may be against the front half. It's a kaleidoscope. You just don't know regionally, generationally, just experience-wise, what the vote will look like at that time. It's a kaleidoscope, and that's the way it was then. We would make count our votes on both sides of the aisle. And when we competed with each other, it was dynamic, it was intellectual. I can't wait to engage in debate on the difference of the role of government. In other words, how significant should the federal government be in local government affairs and this or that? And it was dynamic and wonderful. And some of my best friends on the other side of the aisle, some of them, few still there, on issues that related to human rights and all of that, religious freedom in the world, the Republicans have always been good.
Well, we're
that.
Here in John McCain's old stomping grounds, who was a leader on that.
Beautiful, lovely man. I worked with him. My first bill as whip was his bill, McCain-Feingold. I loved him so much. And Cindy is doing a spectacular job. With him, sometimes we'd be on the same side, sometimes not, but he'd say, keep on fighting. Mm-hmm. He would say to me, keep on fighting. But it is, so then, along to in the 90s, when Bill Clinton was president, along came Newt Gingrich, and he changed the whole thing. Endless money from rich people who didn't really want to pay taxes, and that's still the source of a lot of concern that we have now. But they he would give them like CDs to take home and listen in the car of, you call them traitors, you call them treasonous.
You're talking about to his members.
To the members. Mm-hmm. That and it's sort of
Social media probably has not helped in this regard as well.
No, and then on top of that, social media has exaggerated that. So that's when it started to change. The politics of personal destruction, when they went after the Clintons, as you know, and then, now George Bush was lovely and gracious. We just had disagreements. I mean, I fought him on the war in Iraq. I think it's the biggest destabilizing mistake our country's ever made. But nonetheless, the difference is, are these people patriots or not? And that you have differences of opinion, and that's correct. What you say, what you believe, what you know, what your experience is, what you represent, your district, your name, your job title, and your job description are one and the same, representative. So of course you're going to have different points of view, and that should be respected. But this, once it stops from being a different point of view vis-a-vis our democracy and turns into a Putin caucus in the Republican side, it's a different story.
Well, you were, obviously you were at the center, you and not Nikki Haley were at the center of what happened on January 6th, just for anybody who was confused about that. And it was a terrible, terrible day. Mm-hmm. Now 700 people or more have been convicted for their role in that.
It's so sad.
Donald Trump has called them hostages and said he'd pardon them if he were elected. And I just wanted to elicit a thought from you on that.
Well, it was curious to me that the Robert Kennedy Jr. is now saying he doesn't know if that was an insurrection. What does he not know? Does he not know that they had a noose, that they were going to hang the vice president?
They weren't that hot on you either.
They were shooting me in my, with an F word, head. But not only that, just all the disrespect, defecating all over the floor. Mm-hmm. Taking flags from the Confederacy, Confederate flags, into the Capitol under the dome that Lincoln built. Lincoln built the dome. Having a guy walk around so proudly with an Auschwitz shirt that said 6 million Jews were not enough. This is who they call hostages. And so, look, not political. We want to be unifying and bring people together and the rest. This is a very sick situation. What's his name? He and Netanyahu have a lot in common about their self-preservation and the rest. But January 6th was a terrible day. A terrible, terrible day in our country. Assaulting the Capitol, this beacon of liberty to the world. Okay, that's a building. Right. Assaulting our Constitution. This is the day that we confirm, certify that the Electoral College vote for President of the United States, taking that down, assaulting our democracy, our Constitution, our capital, and the rest. And this guy is going off saying they're hostages. No, they weren't hostages. They were making poo-poo on my desk. I don't know if that's an indication of regular tourists just coming through the building. That's how they described it. There's something really wrong there. And I say to the Republicans, take back your party. You're the grand old party. You've done great things for America. The Democrats don't like me saying that all the time. But they great things for our country. Great leaders have emerged from the Republican Party. Patriots. We may not have agreed, but that's okay. And what does it turn into? A cult to a whatever you want to call them. But it is really a sad thing for our country that they would do that on that day. And then, well, it's political, too, because they know that if they confess to it being what it was, it's bad politically for them. So they're trying to turn it into a regular tourist day at the
Capitol. Did the Justice Department wait too long? You had hearings, and after that, the Justice Department accelerated their investigation into the role that Trump as president and others played. Did they wait too long, do you think? We may not see a trial on January 6th until after the election.
I'll say it this way. I assumed that word, that they were doing research, that they were doing what you do to prepare for a case. I didn't think they were ignoring it because we presented the goods. I was so proud of our.
But do you think that they were they appoint a special counsel after all of that? Should they have acted sooner?
Well, I wish that we were farther along right now. I don't know I'm not in the Justice Department. I don't know if they were ready to go forward. The impression that people have is if we had started sooner, we'd be farther along now. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And look, let me just finish here.
Was that
here.
Diplomatic? Was it?
Yes, I thought it was very artful. You referenced this earlier, what your family went through. Your husband was attacked in your home. How's he doing, by the way?
He's about 80%. He's okay. He's okay. But me and Dad, they came into our home. Where is Nancy? Coming through... drilling through the windows, the door's open, I just meandered in, drilling through the windows with glass, this or that, going through the house, the third floor, to where Dad was, going in, where's Nancy? The same thing that they were saying January 6th, where's Nancy? My dear husband is so lovely, he's not really that political. He would never have imagined when we got married what happened along the way, but it did. Right, Nance? And he's been a good sport, but he's not particularly political. And he's a gentleman. And so even the Republicans say, tell Paul I said hello, because he's always been nice to them, their families, and the rest.
Very warm person.
But this is, imagine. Now, I have security. At the time, as Speaker, second in line to the presidency. So it's a succession thing. A lot of security, this or that. Members don't really have that. And so you're going to run for office, you're going to make sacrifices to follow your beliefs and this or that, and you're going to risk your family's well-being. He was a centimeter away from death. That's what the doctor
said. How did that impact on you personally and your family?
I didn't even know any of that because he would never talk about it. But that's what we read in the paper, saw in the news that the doctor said at the first trial, there's still another trial to come. It's a horrible thing. Your home becomes a crime scene.
Did you feel? I mean, I don't mean to. Did you feel guilty about it?
Definitely. He came there. No, you're exactly right. No, he came there looking for me. He was going to. Oh, and then he said she's in Washington. I just left that day to go to Washington, which this was the night now. And we're just going to wait for her here. And it was terrible. But I don't know that much about it. Because he never talked about it. We don't talk about it. He doesn't want us. And the doctors don't want him reliving it, except what they said in the trial about the centimeter. No, I feel terribly guilty because obviously he was there looking for me, and my dear husband became the victim, and it's a horrible thing. So that's why I say when all these groups come in the middle of the night, ringing doorbells mm-hmm. and bam, bam, beating drums, I'm like, wait a minute, you know, calm down. And they're doing it to a lot of elected officials.
Would you have made a different decision about running? You're running again now.
Huh?
And
well, I'm running again now because we have to win this election, and that's just the way it is.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
But did that affect your thinking at all? Was there ever a point where you said, you know what, my family's had enough. This is too much.
Well, I think you should really know that most families in Congress, anyway, it's a family decision. It's a sacrifice, but it's a family decision. So, no, I'm okay because I didn't want to be Speaker again, or even leader. But I did want to stay to be able to win this election. It's our whole democracy is at stake.
As we go out, we have a lot of young people here. What gives you hope? Because I'd like to see some of these young people sitting in your chair. I'd like to see some of these young women as Speaker of the House.
That's right.
Someday, and maybe even some of these young men.
Yeah.
Tell me.
Well, here's the thing. The future is yours. And I speak to young people all the time. The future is yours. And the fact that many of you want to take responsibility for it gives us all hope.
But a lot of the young people that I spoke with the other day, or several of them, said, one young man stood up and said, you know, I look at the president, I don't think he understands my life, I don't really relate to him. Mm-hmm. They don't see the connection between their concerns and politics. So what do you tell them?
Well, I say, know your power. Know your power in all of this. This is a democracy. Know your power. And when people say, how did you go from housewife to house member to house speaker? I said, don't do this unless you know why. Know your why. My why was 1 in 5 children in America goes to sleep hungry at night. 1 in 5 children in America lives in poverty. I couldn't stand that. As a mother of 5 myself, I couldn't stand that. So that's what motivated me to volunteer, not to run for office or anything, but bump on thing and another. So know your power. Know your why. Why do you want to do this? Do you want to save the planet? Do you want to educate people? Do you want to, is it healthcare? What is your passion about it? And what do you know about it? So know your vision. Know what you're talking about. Be strategic in how you team up with other people to make a difference. And you will be successful. You will be successful. I mean, when I ran, it was like, who said she could run? You know, nobody was laying out any red carpet for me. And even when I ran for leadership, it was like, who said she could run? Yeah, I wasn't waiting for you to tell me I could run, but you poor baby. You thought I was waiting for you? and especially young women, because we really need all of you, young men, women, and the rest, but the young women to know their power about all this. So know why, be ready, know your power. You can make anything happen in a democracy. And it's so necessary, you're so needed. As I said, nothing is more wholesome in the whole process than the, forgive me gentlemen, but the fuller participation of women in politics and government. And I'm very proud. When I went to Congress, there were 12 Democratic women, 11 Republicans, 12 Democrats. And I said, this is, you know, I was a chair of the California Democratic Party. I know how to win elections. We're going to change this. We now have 94 women. Now we want more. We still want more. So let me just tell you one more story to end. So I go.
Cancel your afternoon.
My first event, my first meeting, as a representative of the leader of the Democrats in the House of Representatives. It's a big deal. I mean, I had one, 200 years, nothing, no. And so I go to the White House for the meeting with the president, and you know that meeting. It's the leader, House and Senate, Democratic and Republican leaders, and the president of the United States, sometimes the vice president. So go to the meeting. I wasn't even apprehensive about it because I was top Democrat on intelligence. I was top Democrat in a certain appropriations committee. So I've been in many meetings at the White House. I didn't even give it much of a thought to be concerned. I go in the room, the door closes, and I realize that it was like I'd never been to a meeting like this before in the White House. And in fact, no woman had ever been to a meeting like this before in the White House. They have cabinet meetings where women are present, and that's a beautiful, wonderful, great thing. But I was there as a representative of the House Democrats at the will of the Democrats, not at the pleasure of the president. So it was a different story in terms of what I had to say at the table. You know, my vote counted a lot more than so. So anyway, I'm sitting there, and President Bush, a darling, I mean, the Bush family, I love them. He's saying, welcoming, this is so great. We don't even know, a woman here, and I know we're going to hear some different things from her now. And while he's speaking, I'm all of a sudden, I'm getting closed in on my chair. I'm getting really closed in on my chair, and I didn't know what was happening. And then I realized Susan B. Anthony and Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Sojourner Truth and Alice Paul, they were all on the chair with me. And I could hear them say, at last we have a seat at the table. And then they were gone. And I realized, I mean, I'm standing on their shoulders, of course. We all know that. But that others are standing on mine. So here we are.
Well, there are undoubtedly people here who will be standing on your very, very broad shoulders, Speaker Pelosi. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Axe Files, brought to you by the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Miriam Fender Annenberg. The show is also produced by Sarahlina Berry, Jeff Fox, and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Steve Lichtai and Haley Thomas. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.